From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Last night we heard Israeli planes flying over us. We were about 50 people in the room, about 30 children. Most of the children died.
The kind of killings. The world's called on the UN to investigate the Israeli government for war crimes. The Israeli government says the killings are ultimately Hezbollah's fault. We'll speak with a man who lost more than 40 members of his family in Sunday's attack. He lives in Michigan. Then we'll go back 10 years to the Khan attack of 1996. The Center for Constitutional Rights has filed a class action lawsuit against a top Israeli military official for war crimes. And part two of our interview with Mozambik, author of Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Bagram, Kandahar, and Guantanamo.
That you have no idea when you're going to be released, and you don't have even an inkling as to what it is that you've done to harm this country that has ruined and destroyed your life.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's Security Cabinet has unanimously agreed to expand and deepen its ground attack in southern Lebanon. The country is preparing to call up 15,000 more army reservists. Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert rejected international calls for an immediate ceasefire.
The fighting continues. There is no ceasefire, and there will not be any ceasefire in the coming days.
On Sunday night, the State Department announced Israel will stop bombing southern Lebanon for 48 hours, but Israel resumed airstrikes within a few hours. At the United Nations, Lebanon's acting foreign minister, Tariq Mitri, criticized Israel and the United States for rejecting an immediate ceasefire.
We're disappointed with the fact that the United States of America did not listen to our call for an immediate ceasefire. Our Prime Minister was clear in his telephone conversation with Secretary Rice yesterday afternoon that this is not the time for negotiations, this is the time for the ceasefire, and then the negotiations will resume.
Lebanon's Foreign Minister Tariq Mitri also called on the international community to investigate the Israeli bombing in Khana that killed about 57 civilians, including 37 children.
I would say all Lebanese perceive to be an unjustified collective punishment, and no collective punishment is justified, that is imposed on the civilian population. The spilled blood of the children in Khana deserves more, much more than expressions of regret.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Louise Arbour, strongly condemned the Israeli bombing of Khana and said an independent investigation is needed. The International Committee of the Red Cross criticized what it described as the recurring lack of respect for international humanitarian law by both Israel and Hezbollah. Protests over the bombing of Khana were held throughout the Muslim world, including in Egypt, Iraq, and Pakistan. In southern Lebanon, rescue workers are continuing to dig up bodies buried under the rubble of houses bombed over the past 3 weeks. Lebanon's health ministry estimates there are at least 200 unrecovered bodies. The remains of 40 civilians were uncovered Monday. Thousands of civilians in Tyre and Bint Jebel fled their homes Monday. Residents in Bint Jebel reported spending the last week without food or water.
There's no Bint Jebel anymore. All Bint Jebel was ruined. Our neighborhood was the most ruined place in Bint Jebel. There's no houses. Everywhere is bombings. Everything is ruined. People are dying. They don't know anything.
The Washington Post's Anthony Shadid describes the town center as, quote, a forsaken panorama of destruction and devastation. Meanwhile, on Monday, President Bush dismissed calls for what he described as, quote, stopping for the sake of stopping. He connected Israel's fight against Hezbollah to the September 11th attacks.
The current crisis is part of a larger struggle between the forces of freedom and the forces of terror in the Middle East. For decades, the status quo in the Middle East permitted tyranny and terror to thrive. And as we saw on September the 11th, The status quo in the Middle East led to death and destruction in the United States.
The Jerusalem Post is reporting Israeli military officials have told the paper that they've received indications from the United States that the Bush administration wants Israel to attack Syria. On Monday, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad ordered the country's military to raise its readiness. Israel's been repeatedly bombing sites in Lebanon along the Syrian border. The United Nations Environment Program is expressing grave concern over a massive oil spill off the Lebanese coast in the Mediterranean Sea. The spill occurred when Israel bombed a Lebanese power station. Scientists say almost as much oil may have entered the water as during the 1989 Exxon Valdez tanker incident in Alaska. The oil spill now covers 50 miles of the Lebanese coast. In other news, Cuban President Fidel Castro has temporarily handed over power to his brother Raul. The 79-year-old Castro was forced to undergo surgery for intestinal bleeding. This marks the first time Fidel Castro has temporarily relinquished power since he became president in 1959. The 75-year-old Raul Castro is Cuba's defense minister and first vice president. Under Cuba's constitution, he is first in line to take over from the president in case of incapacitating illness or death. In Miami, thousands of opponents of Fidel Castro celebrated last night after learning of his illness. The Bush administration has already begun laying plans to help a pro-American leader take power after the death of Castro. Last month, the Commission for Assistance to a Free Cuba produced a report calling on the U.S. to spend millions of dollars supporting opponents of Castro. The promised funding has been billed as, quote, democracy promotion. Critics say it'll work to undermine Cuba's government the same way U.S. democracy funding has destabilized regimes in other countries such as Haiti and Venezuela. In Iraq, a series of bomb attacks have killed at least 44 people. 20 Iraqi soldiers traveling on a bus died in a roadside bombing north of Baghdad. Another 14 people died in a suicide car bombing in Baghdad. In Mexico, several hundred thousand protesters are camping out throughout Mexico City to show support for a full recount in last month's presidential election. Presidential runner-up Andrés Manuel López Obrador called for the massive protests during a demonstration Sunday that attracted up to 2 million people. The protests have brought the city's business district to a standstill. The United Nations Security Council has passed a resolution that gives Iran until August 31st to suspend its uranium enrichment and nuclear fuel reprocessing activities or face possible economic sanctions. This marks the first time the Security Council has made legally binding demands on Iran regarding its nuclear program. Meanwhile, in Iran, a student dissident has died in jail while on a hunger strike. The student, Akbar Mohammadi, was arrested 6 years ago for taking part in pro-democracy demonstrations. He's the first political dissident known to have died in prison in Iran in many years. Major General Jeffrey Miller has retired from the Army. On Monday, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal, one of the Army's highest honors. Miller is the general who oversaw the interrogation of detainees at Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. While at Guantanamo, Miller implemented a number of harsh interrogation tactics that included the use of dogs, the stripping of prisoners naked, and the shackling of prisoners in stress positions to force them to talk. Such tactics later were used in Iraq. Miller had originally tried to retire in February, but he was denied his request because there were a series of investigations and court-martials underway. Army experts say now appears unlikely Miller will face any disciplinary action in connection with Abu Ghraib abuse scandal. British Prime Minister Tony Blair and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger have agreed to work together to fight global warming by reducing greenhouse gas emissions and promoting low-carbon technologies. The two met at a summit on climate change in California. The meetings were also attended by the heads of 25 major corporations, including BP, DuPont, and Goldman Sachs. The Bush administration decided not to send a representative to the meeting. On Tuesday, Schwarzenegger said the debate over global warming is over and that California can't wait for the Bush administration to take action.
I think the message is that we do not wait for the federal government, that we will move forward because we know it is the right thing to do. This state is going to lead on that issue, and I think that we will get other states involved, the other western states involved.
In news from Washington, the House of Representatives has voted to increase the federal minimum wage by $2.10. However, the bill is being criticized because Republican lawmakers added on a measure that would extend cuts to the estate tax for the wealthiest Americans. And ABC Television has announced it's canceling plans to work with Mel Gibson's production company to make a miniseries about the Holocaust. Gibson directed The Passion of the Christ. He was arrested on Friday for drunk driving. At the time of his arrest, Gibson reportedly unleashed an anti-Semitic tirade. He asked the arresting officer, "Are you a Jew?" He then said, quote, "The Jews are responsible for all the wars in the world." This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Sunday, Israeli warplanes bombed the village of Kana at about 1 a.m. A missile hit a three-story building where relatives from two extended families were seeking refuge. Rescue workers were unable to reach the site for hours because Israeli warplanes continued to attack the area. No weapons were found in the building that was hit. In all, as many as 57 civilians were killed in the attack, including 37 children. There were only 8 survivors. Today, Human Rights Watch has called the Israeli attack on Kana a war crime. As we continue our coverage of the Kana bombing, we turn to part 2 of our interview with veteran war correspondent Robert Fisk. In 1996, Fisk reported on that year's massacre at Kana. And now in 2006, Robert Fisk is in Lebanon to cover the current war. We spoke to him early on Monday in Beirut. He had just returned home after spending the day in Tyre, where the victims from Kana were brought after the attack.
You heard Sharon before he suffered his massive stroke. Actually used this phrase in the Knesset, that, you know, the Palestinians must feel pain. This was during one of the intifadas. The idea that if you continue to beat and beat and beat the Arabs, they will submit. That eventually they'll go on their knees and do what you want. And this is totally, utterly self-delusional because it doesn't apply anymore. It used to apply. 30 years ago, when I first arrived in the Middle East, if the Israelis crossed the Lebanese border, the Palestinians jumped in their cars and drove to Beirut and went to the cinema. Now, when the Israelis cross the Lebanese border, the Hezbollah jump in their cars in Beirut and race to the south to join battle with them. The key thing now is that Arabs are not afraid anymore. Their leaders are afraid. The Mubaraks of this world, the president of Egypt, King Abdullah II of Jordan, they're afraid. They shake and tremble in their golden mosques because they were supported by us. But the people are no longer afraid. Whether this is because they've grown tired of being afraid, and as I say, once you lose your fear, you cannot be re-injected with fear. You can't stop being frightened again. Or whether it's because our Western forces are now at war with Islamists, not with nationalists. That I'm not sure. You know, 30 years ago, it was the nationalist secular PLO whom the Israelis claim were the center of world terror, or whatever you like to call it. We bombed the Suez city at the time of the Suez crisis in 56 because of Nasser's Arab nationalism. We bombed Gaddafi for his nationalism and his acts of, quote, world terror, unquote. Now, the British and Americans in Afghanistan are fighting Islamists. The British and Americans in Iraq are fighting Islamists. The Israelis are fighting Islamists in Gaza. They're fighting Islamists in Lebanon. It's not the same enemy, and they're not running away anymore. And that is what is going to doom us in this crazed conflict which we continue to provoke and which enrages us when the conflict reaches us and strikes back, and because it destroys our beautiful buildings and our tube trains and our buses.
Robert Fisk of The Independent, he's lived in Beirut for 3 decades. I asked him whether he thinks the current crisis in Lebanon can be seen as a proxy war between the United States and Iran or Syria.
Yeah, I have no doubt. And that's what the Americans think. Bolton keeps saying in the United Nations that Syria is behind Hezbollah. Bush said the same at the G8 summit in St. Petersburg when he was caught in his shit comments by the microphone. And they're right, but for the wrong reasons, of course. But they don't, I think that nowadays there's such a distance between reality and Washington that there's no comprehension of what this means on the ground. I mean, Bolton, most Arab leaders and diplomats realize that Bolton's a bit cracked. I mean, he needs medical rather than political help. But other than that, it's very difficult to bridge the gap between the realities of terror and pain in the hospital wards and Condoleezza Rice using her honeyed words at a press conference next to Mr. Olmert. I noticed she was told she was forbidden to come to Lebanon today. Fitzsignora, the Lebanese Prime Minister, whom I know quite well, actually told her, don't come to Lebanon, you're not welcome anymore. We'll tell you when you can come back. And Rice humbly said, well, I've got more work to do here in Israel. I'm sure she has. Yes, I'm sure she has. But, you know, it was very interesting. Last time Rice came to Beirut, she holds press conferences in Israel, but she doesn't hold press conferences here because she knows the questions are going to be too terrible. She makes statements and she leaves. But, you know, it's in keeping with our leader. Making the comment the other day that, you know, when I grew up, the prime ministers of my country were Anthony Eden, Winston Churchill. Churchill's not my greatest hero, but these were all men who'd been in the First World War, and of course in the Second. Even when I was posted to Northern Ireland as a correspondent in the 70s, the first Secretary of State was called William Whitelaw, British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, and he'd been in the crossing of the Rhine. These were people who had experienced war at first hand, and they knew that it was war as an obscenity. It's about death rather than victory or defeat. But we have nobody now in government in the West, not in the Bush administration. Well, Bush managed to avoid Vietnam. Cheney avoided Vietnam. Colin Powell was in Vietnam, but he's no longer in the administration in Washington. But we have no one left in the Blair or Bush governments now who have any first-hand practical experience of the obscenity of war. And they think when they make these statements that they're talking about their experience, which is of Hollywood or television movies. I think an analyst in Britain, quite a good academic, agreed with me on this point on the BBC the other day and added that perhaps we should, I did not realize the degree to which 9/11 continued to traumatize the United States. And that may be true. Although I have to say it's time it stopped traumatizing the United States. You know, it's time that 9/11 was placed in the context of what was actually happening in the rest of the world. You know, we keep being told, oh, 9/11 changed the world forever. I'm not going to let 19 Arab murderers change my world, and nor should you in America. I'm not going to let the 7th of July bombs on the in front of the Piccadilly line train that blew up. I'm not going to let that change my world and allow my government to commit these outrageous abuses of human rights, torture in Guantanamo, in Bagram, in Iraq, in Abu Ghraib. But we let our leaders do these things. We let them get away with it. And so we have more wars, and we will have more.
Robert Fisk reporting from Beirut. He had just spent the day in Tyre, where victims of the Qana attack were taken. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, part two of our discussion with Mozambique, held in U.S. prisons for more than 3 years at Guantanamo, at Bagram, as well as at Kandahar. But first, we'll take a closer look at the Qana massacre of 1996, 10 years ago. A law firm is bringing a class action suit against a top Israeli military official for that attack. Stay with us.
Oh,
Pavan Singh Mustard Fields here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we take a closer look at another massacre that took place at Kana, it was 10 years ago. In April of 1996, the Israeli Defense Force shelled Kana's UN compound, killing 106 civilians who'd been seeking refuge inside. Initially, the Israeli government denied responsibility for the deaths, but after a United Nations investigation condemned Israel's actions, the Israeli government changed their story. In December of last year, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a class action lawsuit against former IDF Chief of Staff and Head of Intelligence, Lieutenant General Moshe Ya'alon. The suit alleges Ya'alon commanded the attack and is guilty of war crimes, extrajudicial killings, and crimes against humanity. Ya'alon is currently a distinguished fellow at the U.S.-based think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We're joined right now by Maria LaHood. She's an attorney on the case with the Center for Constitutional Rights. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, we're hearing a lot about what happened today. Actually, this weekend in Dearborn, Michigan, there was a protest of up to 1,000 people protesting the current attack on Kana. They gathered at the memorial for the Kana attack of 1996. What happened then? Why are you involved?
The military operation in 1996 was not dissimilar to what's happening now. The IDF had started to bomb and shell the villages in southern Lebanon in order to try to disarm Hezbollah and try to put pressure on the Lebanese government to get rid of Hezbollah. It was going on for probably 3 weeks. There were about 700,000 displaced persons from southern Lebanon, and a lot of them had taken refuge in UN compounds. One of the compounds was in Kana, and about 800 people had taken refuge there. On April 18th, the IDF actually targeted the compound, killing over 100 civilians, like you said, and wounding even more. We represent the victims of that attack against, as you said, Moshe Ya'alon, who at the time was head of the IDF intelligence. The lawsuit alleges war crimes, crimes against humanity, and extrajudicial killing, and the plaintiffs are seeking justice and accountability for this attack.
Who were the plaintiffs?
The plaintiffs include, well, the named, it's a class action, so we represent all of the people, all the survivors, all the victims, but the named plaintiffs, for example, Sadali Ali Belhas, he lost his wife and his 9 children. Altogether, he lost 31 members of his family. His son, Ali Belhas, lost his wife and 3 of his children. He saw his newborn decapitated. They weren't able to leave, southern Lebanon because they had a newborn. And like the people now who have been subject to these attacks, they don't have the means to get out of the area. So are stuck seeking shelter in other places.
We were just listening to Robert Fisk's report of the Independent of London, who's lived in Beirut for decades. And he was the reporter who exposed that there was an unmanned Israeli drone when Israel was saying they didn't know refugees were in this compound that was taking pictures that saw the people below.
Right. At first, they denied that there was a drone until UN videotape showed that there was a drone before the attacks and even during the attacks. The video showed the drone at the same time as the shelling was going on. It wasn't only that that showed that they knew that there were civilians inside. The UN actually called the IDF about 1 minute into the shelling and said, "You are shelling a UN compound." The shelling continued for 17 more minutes before it stopped. There were no stray shells. Every shell hit the UN compound, and it actually the shells hit the most densely populated areas, the heaviest.
The Israeli military official Ya'alon, you served him with papers where?
At the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he's been a fellow since at least November.
Was his response?
He tossed the papers aside and then I think later claimed that he wasn't served. But he was, and he's represented in court by Arnold and Porter. They've claimed that he has foreign sovereign immunity, that he's protected by the cloak of official immunity by the Israeli government. You know, we've argued that a government can't authorize war crimes or crimes against humanity and can't claim immunity for those.
And what is the legal principle on which you're filing this class action suit?
We've sued under the Alien Tort Claims Act and also the Torture Victim Protection Act. The Alien Tort Claims Act, also called the Alien Tort Statute, allows non-citizens to sue for for damages for violations of customary international law, such as war crimes or crimes against humanity.
Now, this is a centuries-old statute, is that
1789,
right?
1789,
aimed at getting pirates on the high seas. So you don't, these people don't have to live in the United States who have sued, but they can sue on U.S. soil if the person comes to the United States?
Right. The plaintiffs, actually, for the Alien Tort Statute, have to be non-citizens. Not so for the Torture Victim Protection Act. The court has jurisdiction over the defendant as long as the defendant is served in the United States.
So where does the case go from here?
So right now, the defendant has moved to dismiss the case based not only on the foreign sovereign immunities grounds I've mentioned, but also on so-called political question grounds, claiming that the case will interfere with U.S. foreign relations because Israel is a key U.S. ally in the war on terror, essentially. The motion has been fully briefed, and we're waiting to hear whether the judge in the D.C. court will have oral argument or we'll just make a decision on whether the case can move forward.
And have you discovered new information in the process of this lawsuit?
We have not yet been entitled to discovery. I mean, we have public evidence and other evidence, but nothing from the defendant or from Israel.
Maria LaHood, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Maria LaHood is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. I want to thank you very much for being here. As we turn now to the second part of our interview with Mozan Beg. Mozan is a British citizen, former prisoner at Guantanamo Bay, written a book about his experience that's just been published in the United States called Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. It's the first book known to be published by a former Guantanamo Bay prisoner. It was co-written with Victoria Britton, a former associate foreign editor at the Guardian newspaper. Mozan Beg joined us in our studio live, well, not exactly our studio, but he joined us by satellite from Birmingham, England, where he lives. We conducted the interview live during the broadcast and continued afterwards. This is part two. Mozan Beg, I wanted to talk to you about the effect or how much communication you had with your family, with people on the outside. And before you answer that question, I wanted to turn to your father, Asmat Beg, who joined us in the studio in the midst of your imprisonment. You were at Guantanamo at the time. He had come to the United States to let people know what was happening to you, his son. This is Asmat Beg.
Well, that's about 2 years now, so over 2 years now. He was taken from his house in front of his daughter and his wife, and two American soldiers, assisted by two Pakistan soldiers, pulled him out, bundled him up, and put it into the trunk of the car and took away. And he rang me up from the trunk of the car, possibly he had mobile, and he told me in the middle of the night here in England that, Daddy, I have been arrested. I said, what for? It was very whispering sort of noise. I couldn't believe. He said, I have been arrested, Daddy. I said, why? He said, I don't know. And they are taking me somewhere which I do not know. Please take care of my wife and children who are at so-and-so address in Islamabad.
Where? Asmat Beg, speaking to us about 10 months before Mozan Beg was eventually released. You called your father from the trunk of the car where you had been shackled and thrown in Islamabad?
I think my father got it slightly wrong. It wasn't from the back of the vehicle. It was actually inside the cell where I was held. One of the reasons why I maintain, of course, that this was a kidnap and not an arrest, which is people often say, is because they didn't even conduct a body search. Had they done that, they would have found my phone was still in my pocket. And so the first person I've called was my father. I whispered on the phone down to him, and I remember him being so shaken that he whispered back. But my father was obviously, as I said, shaken and didn't know what to do, but I asked him also to take care of my family, to ask other family members who lived in Pakistan to come and visit them and to make sure that they're okay, and to also approach some lawyers. It wasn't an arrest. It wasn't that we could follow any legal procedure in at least trying to obtain a court appearance or a charge or anything of that nature. I was carried away by people unknown to me. Place. They actually said to me the terms, you have been illegally detained. And I said, what does that mean? And they said it means that you're held in a position by us illegally, but because nobody knows that you're here, there's nothing really that you can do about it.
How important was your father's activism? This country, I believe at the time, he was here with Vanessa Redgrave, the actor, and Corin Redgrave, her brother. What difference did it make, his making your case known?
I think wherever I go, wherever I speak, and I think I've spoken at hundreds of events and venues, my father's voice has preceded me, happily so. His campaigning has been vociferous, diligent, and constant. People from all walks of life that I've come across, even from the British Foreign Office themselves, have conceded the point that my father's campaign was very dignified and very persistent. He met with members of the British cabinet. He met with people on the ground who were campaigning. He was also helping to campaign for release of other detainees and their families. And he went to the very doors of the White House itself to call for justice for his son. So I think this is what I've learnt in hindsight now that I've returned. And I owe that man, who's my father, a great deal he's done to highlight not just my case, but by extension, the whole of the issue of Guantanamo Bay, at least in this country, if not in the greater world.
Mozambique, you were born in England?
That's correct, yes, in this city.
In Birmingham. Why did
that's
you
correct,
choose
yes.
to leave? Why did you go to Afghanistan and Pakistan? Can you talk about the trajectory of your, of your life?
Yes, I think that, first of all, this type of question, we're living in a huge sort of global village now, where it's easy to be in one point of the world and the other side of it in the same day. There are British expatriates all around the world, at every corner of the globe you can think of, deep in the Amazon jungle or elsewhere. It seems that because I've gone to Afghanistan to live with my wife and my kids to work on a project that I believe was of social benefit, somehow there is some suspicion behind it because I'm a Muslim, I was active in supporting Muslim causes in Chechnya or in Bosnia, and therefore I must be synonymous with terrorism and a terrorist type. It was important for me during the 90s, as part of a search for my own of identity of faith and nationality, in broadening my horizons about how I fitted in with the rest of the world and the rest of the people of who I related to, which was Muslims. That a lot of people take, they don't necessarily take it to Afghanistan or elsewhere, but I do remember when I was living in Afghanistan, right across the road, there were a family of Americans who shortly left after I arrived, but nonetheless they were part of an NGO, as indeed were there were Germans and French and Brits living there, non-Muslims, Caucasians, working in Afghanistan and living there, and trying to do a job what they felt was of social benefit to the people. I think that this is still a problem that people face when they're traveling now, particularly people with my sort of a background, in that suspicions arise, not least because of what happened on September the 11th, because of hijackings and so forth. But to be able to throw off this suspicion in the world that we're living in today is extremely difficult, because there are you don't have the ability to combat or to challenge these sort of spurious allegations that have been put against me. And you know, after 300 interrogations, after 3 years of incarceration, after the MI5, the CIA, the FBI, the military intelligence of the United States of America pitting all their wits against me for all this time, still they came up with nothing. It's a great shame.
I wanted to ask you about the comment of U.S. government officials, as well as a military interrogator. He was quoted on the PBS program Now. His name is Chris Hogan. He was at, I believe it was Bagram, at the same time you were. This is the military interrogator, Chris Hogan.
I think that he would be mischaracterized if you said that he was a high-level enemy fighter or planner with the capacity to wreak havoc on the U.S. or its interests. I always had the impression that he was a bit of a romanticist, but at the same time, the image that he paints of himself now, as one as being someone who was an innocent being persecuted by the enormous machine, is not accurate.
Chris Hogan, being interviewed by PBS's Now. Mozambeg, your response.
I remember Chris, and I've read his book since I've returned, The Interrogator's War. I only ever spoke to him, actually, I think once, when he offered me a copy of the Bible, which I'd asked for when I was in Bagram, because I was having a discussion with some guards, and I wanted to make some comparisons between it and the Quran. But I never had any, he was never interrogating me, or he never had any conversations with me. I felt that he was a decent chap, that he was he was not one of the abusers by any standards, just from his demeanor and how he behaved with other detainees, from what I saw. And I suppose, in a sense, he could be right, that I was a romantic, that I believed in concepts which pushed me to go to Bosnia and elsewhere. But despite all of that, my position would be this, is that what is it? I want to know, what is it actually tangibly that I've done to harm the United States of America? I've certainly had opportunity. If I wanted to go and join any terrorist organization, it wouldn't be too difficult to do that. I mean, I think John Walker Lind has proved that it's possible to join the Taliban, whoever, if you wanted to. But I didn't do that. And what is it, I want to know, that I've done to the United States to harm them? Now, in response to that, of course, is I can say all the things that they've done to harm me and my family and the people that I'm a part of, which is the Muslim people. And he has ruined the lives of my children. I had a child born 6 months after I was taken into custody. People say that, you know, somehow I've managed miraculously to survive all of this after the abuses that I faced. And for Chris to say that, that I paint myself as somebody who's being persecuted as an innocent is not correct. Well, why is it then that even the United States government has been so vociferously active in supporting the war on terror? Even the Supreme Court now has ruled that President Bush's actions in relation to setting up these kangaroo courts of commissions have deemed to be illegal. Then why is it that the world is outcrying that Guantanamo Bay in place like that should be closed? Why is Kofi Annan saying what he said? Why are the United Nations reports so powerful and vociferous about closing the place down? Why is it that even the senior legal advisor to the British government itself has called unequivocally for the closure of the place? The fact is that people are being persecuted there. They may not be having their fingernails and toenails pulled out, but the absence of the rule of law, the fact that you're in a legal limbo, the fact that you have no meaningful communication with your family, the fact of the cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, the fact of psychological abuse, that you have no idea and you don't have even an inkling as to what it is that you've done to harm this country that has ruined and destroyed your life.
Mozambeg, I wanted to read to you from the New York Times a piece they did on you and get your response to what they say. They say, inspired by the guerrilla's commitment, he threw himself into helping besiege Muslims in Bosnia and Herzegovina. He said he traveled to the Balkans 9 or 10 times with a small aid agency, Convoy of Mercy, but the group's founder, Asad Khan, said he had no recollection of Mr. Beg. Defense Department officials said one of Mr. Beg's former associates was Omar Saeed Sheikh, who volunteered on a convoy trip in 1993. Mr. Sheikh was later convicted of kidnapping Western tourists in India and is facing execution in Pakistan for the murder of the Wall Street Journal correspondent Daniel Pearl. Mr. Beg insisted he did not know Mr. Sheikh. Could you respond to both of these issues?
Yeah, I think there are two things. First of all, the insinuation that going to Bosnia is somehow synonymous with terrorism. Let's not forget, you know, I didn't do anything in Bosnia, and although I think I would have been justified if I took part in some sort of ability to defend the Bosnian Muslims who were being massacred. But I think, you know, let's not forget the Americans were the ones who bombed and killed many of the Serbs. And, you know, it's one of the things that I agree with to some degree, as long as it didn't harm any civilians. But the insinuation about Omar Sheikh Saeed, I think his name is, why is it? Where's the evidence for this? I mean, if I say that I don't know the man, then you need to prove otherwise. There has to be some sort of tangible proof. The fact that what they say is that he worked or went on a convoy with the Convoy of Mercy, therefore means that I must have met him because I'm also from Birmingham, when in fact I'm from London, and that over a period of 3 or 4 years, however long the convoy was running for, that I would probably have bumped into him. It is ludicrous. The Convoy of Mercy had scores of people working for it at any given time. I'd never heard of Omar Sheikh up until his case was highly portrayed in the media about how he'd been arrested by the Indian authorities. And again, my point about all of this is that if you have this sort of proof, and it is, if it's actionable, then action it, bring it forward. But to sort of lay these allegations, which amount to nothing in the media for the sake of spin, is really quite debasing for themselves.
Mozan Beg speaking to us from Birmingham, England, where he now lives with his family after being imprisoned by the United States at Bagram, Guantanamo and Kandahar for more than 3 years. He's written his memoir. It's called Enemy Combatant. We'll be back with him in a minute. Karn here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report is a return to our interview with Mozan Beg. He has written a book about his experiences called Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. We spoke to him at a studio in his hometown of Birmingham, England. The New York Times goes on to say that your book, Enemy Combatant, does not mention one Palestinian friend, Khalil Deek, who also lived in Peshawar at the time. The United States 9/11 Commission described Deek, a naturalized American, as an associate of Abu Zubaydah, a senior al-Qaeda lieutenant of Palestinian descent who was also in Peshawar, then recruiting new operatives and sending them to train at Afghan camps. An American counterterrorism official who began tracking Mr. Beg in 1999 said the CIA and MI5, Britain's domestic intelligence service, suspected Mr. Beg of working with Mr. Deek to create a CD-ROM version of a terrorist manual, Encyclopedia of Jihad, which Mr. Deek gave to two Palestinians who plotted with Mr. Zubaydah to bomb tourist sites in Jordan. And the New York Times article goes on to say American intelligence officials also said Deek helped arrange transportation to Jordan for some operatives in the foiled plot, but after being held in Jordan for 17 months, he was released without charge. And the Times says Beg acknowledged in an interview he'd met Mr. Deek in Bosnia, later invested with him in a small business deal to sell traditional Pakistani clothing, but said he never met Abu Zubaydah, something Pentagon officials said he had admitted to his interrogators. He also denied an assertion by Mr. Whitman, the Pentagon spokesman, that he spent 5 days in early 1998 at Durunta, a notorious al-Qaeda-affiliated training camp in Afghanistan, learning about poisons and explosives. Mozan Beg, your response.
Well, yeah, there are a whole load of things there that you've mentioned. Yes, Mr. Deke, I did meet Mr. Deke, and I maintain that I met him in Bosnia, and I met him, I did do that thing with the clothes in relation to selling them from Pakistan to Britain. And that's it. These are airy accusations that are not based on any proofs. I've mentioned quite clearly, if there is a crime here, tell me what it is, let's go to court, let's hammer it out. What has Mr. Deke been convicted of? What has even Abu Zubaydah been convicted of? In fact, recently I read a book that's written by somebody who works maintains that Zubaydah himself is not this lieutenant of Al-Qaeda, and in fact is a very low-key player, somebody who's been beefed up since 9/11 to be a strategist and so forth. All we have is the intelligence, the US intelligence, and perhaps to some degree the British intelligence word for it. We don't have independent inquiries. We have no way of knowing, no way of checking all of the allegations, all of the statements that are made. We know that the US administration, in cahoots with its own intelligence service, has used evidence extracted under torture to enter into Iraq on a pretext that Al-Qaeda was working to obtain weapons of mass destruction via Saddam Hussein. So how is it that we're supposed to take their word for it? And again, in relation to me knowing Deke or the possibility that I might have met Zubaydah and so forth, where on earth here is there a crime? What is it that I'm supposed to have done? Again, I'm asking, what is it that I've done to harm the Americans? I have not been involved in the setting up of this so-called CD. I have no knowledge of how to set CDs up, and certainly in 1999, I had very little computer knowledge other than being able to use an email. And what is it that Mr. Deke was supposed to be convicted of? You make an allegation against somebody, and then you find out that in fact he wasn't guilty of anything, then he's freed and released, and still you're trying to argue that this allegation holds. On what basis? It's again these sort of spurious allegations. Even if, let's say for argument's sake, all of the things that the Americans maintain, that I went to a training camp in 1993, that I went in 1998, that I met Deke, that I have even met Zubaydah, does all of this now justify American actions? Does it justify to torture somebody, to beat them, to have them threatened with rape, to have them hear the sounds of a woman screaming, to have them be debased cruelly, inhumanly, and degradingly? Is all of that justified to deny them the rights to access of the law? This is the question that people need to ask, because after all, some of the worst convicted terrorist killers, convicts on earth, have better access to general facilities than any of the detainees do in Guantanamo Bay.
Mozambeg, in your book, Enemy Combatant, you talk about Timothy McVeigh. Why do you raise this case?
I think it's very important. One of the questions that I was asked, I remember for a joke, I told one of the guards in Kandahar, I said, what are you here for? I said, oh, I knew Timothy McVeigh. And the guard actually believed me. It seems so strange and bizarre that he would actually make this link, that he felt that somehow Timothy McVeigh could be involved, or people who knew Timothy McVeigh could be involved in all of this. But the reason why I bring this all up, of course, is that Timothy McVeigh killed over 150 people. There were people that he was involved with too, the Michigan militia, the people that he trained with, the people who showed him how to use weapons and explosives. They're still running around the mountains of Michigan, training and fighting and preparing for this, for some sort of a war in the middle of America. And yet they weren't bombed and arbitrarily detained and held in such ways. One person was caught, which was Timothy McVeigh, and executed. But what of the ideology that pushed him? Because the rhetoric that we hear about all of this war on terror is that we're fighting the ideology. We imprison people in a preemptive way to stop them from committing acts of terror. Then what about Timothy McVeigh's associates and the people in America through all of the militias and the armed groups and so forth that continue to plague the United States of America by carrying weapons openly and indiscriminately, shooting people? Surely that is an aspect of terrorism. But because it's homegrown, it was argued to me by many interrogators, this is something that we could deal with. What we can't deal with is something that's from outside of the state, and we have to deal with it in a military response. They launched the war on terror, but of course, terrorism is a crime. You don't launch wars on crime. You crack crime. You solve crime. And to say that somehow the military is going to be able to, is now a crime fighter, removes the ability or the understanding of people, what people have, of what crime's supposed to be about.
Mozambique, I don't know if the word befriended is appropriate, but you came to know your prison guards. One of them, you believe, involved in a murder. Can you talk about him and where you were?
This was in Bagram in 2002, I believe, around June or sort of midsummer. One of these guards, this was one of the guards that I became sort of friendly with and close with in Kandahar. And one of the things he said to me was that he'd grown up on a Cherokee reservation in North Carolina and fought his way up as a youth to earn their respect. And so it was a subject that I was fascinated by, about by the Native Americans. And so we built up a rapport and relationship. Later, he and I were both transferred to Bagram. In Bagram, he began to become a little desensitized. But prior to that, he'd actually said to me that when I see you people, it reminds me of my people. And he was talking about Native Americans, in that how they were initially demonized because of the language that they spoke, because of the color of their skin, because of their religion, because of their eating habits, because of all their persona. And he felt that we were being dehumanized in a similar way. But he became so desensitized that I remember he told me after this detainee had tried to escape that he'd administered elbow and knee blows to him so hard that his arm had to be in a cast for several days after the beating. I'd seen him start shouting and screaming at the detainees in order for them to be, for him to try to make himself understood, which of course he couldn't because he didn't speak their language. And sadly, he'd been involved in committing this killing, which was extremely difficult for me because he was somebody I felt was, initially at least, one of the decent people there. And and yet he'd done this terrible deed.
Mozambique, as you talk to us today, you're in Birmingham, England, where in the United States. Your book is being released in the United States, Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, Kandahar. But you can't come here. In fact, you can't leave England. Is that right? The British authorities have your passport?
No, I have my own passport, but the British authorities have put a condition on me traveling abroad, which is something that I have to make representation for. It's my own decision, my own choice, not to make a representation to travel to the United States, and not least because I don't want to be imprisoned and incarcerated again on a whim, but also that they've turned back people from this country, like the former Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam, the singer, and also even people like Zaki Badawi, who was the most senior Muslim advisor to the British government. So if they're going to turn people like that away, I think that I stand very little chance. So I would rather not even make the application.
And finally, when you were brought to Guantanamo and held largely in solitary confinement, you say that the physical abuse was not as intense at Guantanamo as what you experienced in Afghanistan. But can you talk about the psychological abuse that you experienced at Guantanamo, and whether in the end you felt that was the most difficult part for you and for other prisoners there?
You know, by the time I was sent to Guantanamo Bay, I was actually looking forward to it after having spent such a long time in Bagram, not having seen a natural light or even the sun or the moon or the stars for almost 11 months. So I was almost looking forward to it because I was told there that it would at least be the beginning of the end. Oh, a very long end, as it turned out to be, of course. I wouldn't call them physical violations in comparison to what I sustained in Bagram. There were things like being chained to the floor for 8 or 9 hours just so that an interrogator wanted to see me. I don't know whether that's because of incompetence on the part of the guards or whether it was part of a design. Perhaps it was a little bit of both. That happened on several occasions, not being able to move, not being able to go to the toilet, not being able to do anything because you're chained physically to the floor. On other occasions, when I needed medical treatment, sometimes I was taken and held in hospital, in a very state-of-the-art type of hospital with the equipment that they used. But it included having my legs and hands shackled to the bed so that I couldn't move. And that was very inhumane treatment. I think the hardest part of Guantanamo for me was the solitude, the isolation that I spent in Camp Echo with no access to any other detainees or any meaningful communication with my family, which was often letters that I received through the International Committee of the Red Cross that had either been severely obscured and censored Even letters from my seven-year-old daughter had been greatly crossed out. And also the fact that being in an 8-foot by 6-foot cell, not being able to take more than 3 steps either way for such a long time, other than the recreation yard that I was given access to a couple of times a week initially, which increased. So all of that had a great amount of psychological effect. I was in a room, in essence, that there was no natural light in at all. I couldn't see whether it was day or night unless I managed to peek through the side of the cell and look at the through the door when the guard opened the door. But the one thing that did happen was that I managed, because I was in close proximity to a guard at any given time, to establish very cordial and friendly relations with several of the guards, to learn from them firsthand about how they felt, not just about this where they were, but to also to transfer and to go off to their normal lives, their day-to-day lives in how they lived in America, and for me to reciprocate and to talk about how I lived back in the UK and elsewhere, and how our lives were close and how our lives were different. And I think that helped to break a lot of the ice and break a lot of the stereotyped images that they had of these detainees who were deemed by the government to be killers, terrorists, dangerous people. I would maintain happily to this day that many of those guards that I came across, even interrogators, some of the interrogators, were extremely decent, humane people who I would happily call my friends if they would allow me to do so.
Mozambique, finally, where do you go from here?
That's a difficult question because, you know, this story is not just about me, even though the book is about me. It's much bigger. It's even bigger than Guantanamo. It's bigger than Bagram and Kandahar because it's now part of something that's so huge that, sadly, as long as places like these black holes of detention exist, the ones that are known like Bagram, Kandahar, and Guantanamo, and the ones that are unknown that may be in Diego Garcia and elsewhere, perhaps in Thailand or in Egypt, I have a sad but important job to do, and that is to try to explain, to sometimes be a bridge between misunderstanding and recognizing where people are going wrong on both sides, and to point out quite clearly that the abuses that are taking place in Guantanamo and elsewhere need to be stopped. But of course, you know, just recently today we've been told that Camp 6 has been built, something I knew from a long time ago, another state-of-the-art super maximum security prison installation in Guantanamo Bay, and that is there to stay. At the cost of tens of millions of dollars, I can't see the United States government closing it down, despite the fact that President Bush recently, after the suicide, said that he would like to see the place closed. I think he was playing to a public voice, not to the reality on the ground.
Mozambique, author of Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. Last year, he was released from the U.S. prison at Guantanamo. He had been imprisoned for a total of about 3 years, speaking to us from Birmingham, England, where he lives with his family. That is the end of today's program. If you'd like to get a transcript or the video or audio pod of the show, the podcast, or if you'd like to hear the full interview with Robert Fisk in Beirut, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrew from Dokudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, and Frank Lopez. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg Peshkin and Megan Whitney and Samantha Chambly, Uri Galed, and Angela Alston. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.